Tonight, I'm going to talk about two kinds of blind faith. The first kind is a blind faith in Darwin's theory of evolution. And the second is a blind faith in a literal interpretation of the Bible, in particular the first chapter of Genesis, a literal interpretation of how the world was made. It is, in fact, this year the centenary of the death of Charles Darwin. And it's interesting that recently, in the prestigious scientific paper Nature, there is a paper entitled The Death of Darwin in South Kensington. In fact, it's the editorial. The death of Darwin in South Kensington. What does it mean? It arises out of a controversy following an exhibition at the Natural History Museum in South Kensington, where the new director had set out the exhibits in such a way as to illustrate the facts of evolution, but put forward no attempt to account for them by any theory, let alone the theory of Darwin. And this caused quite a rumpus. Although the rumpus, nothing like that is going on in America at the moment, between the Darwinists on the one hand and the creationists on the other, which will be leading to another set of court cases in the near future over what textbooks can be used in schools for the teaching of biology to children. This theory of Darwin's, which became established not long after he wrote his famous Origin of Species in 1859, has been one of the big causes for many people to feel that there is no longer any reason or need to believe in a divine creator. Darwin's theory is extremely simple. In fact, it's its very simplicity which has made it catch on with ordinary men and women in a way that Einstein's theory of relativity never could have done because of its complexity and difficulty of visualization. Darwin's theory of evolution is simple in the extreme. That is not a criticism of it, it's merely a statement of fact. Sometimes the simplest things can be the best ways of understanding truth. What is Darwin's theory? His theory of evolution runs roughly like this. Species of living things and living creatures from time to time show variations in their form. Some of these variations will be more fitted for survival in the environment in which the creature is living, and others will be less adapted. A process which Darwin called natural selection operates to effectively weed out the strains that are strong in the environment so that they produce progeny, and those that are weak eventually cease to produce progeny and die out. These variations, which are maintained, the ones which are adapted to the environment, gradually accumulate until a new species is formed. Darwin's theory needed a long period of time to operate for it to seem feasible. But with modern methods of radiometric radiocarbon dating, it is possible for us now to realize that the age of the Earth is extremely great. The order of a billion years or so. Darwin's theory then appears to satisfy the criterion of a simple theory to explain the origin of life. The Darwinists were so taken up with their theory that it seemed to them that they were able to explain life without any kind of creative designer or cosmic designer. And that is one area in which they made a fatal mistake. Now, in helping you to understand this subject, which is coming into the news at the moment, I want to help you to distinguish between two aspects of evolution. These two are skated over or not mentioned at all in most of the textbooks on biology, thereby obscuring one of the great weaknesses in Darwin's theory. That is the difference between macroevolution and microevolution. Now, those two words mean quite simply, microevolution is change which takes place within a species without producing any new species, such as a stronger strain of wheat or a rat with different coloured eyes, and so on. Macroevolution refers to evolution from one species to another. Now, these two have been frequently confused, or the difference not brought out at all, in the textbooks. And I want to begin by, first of all, looking at the subject of macroevolution, that is to say, how one species develops into another. Now, it is here that the fossil record, that's to say the bones that archaeologists dig up from different strata of rocks, from which, by means of radiocarbon dating, they can determine roughly the age. These fossils show enormous gaps. Not small gaps in the record, but enormous gaps. And these gaps occur at all the worst places from the Darwinists' point of view. It couldn't be worse for them. Now, this is so bad that it's not surprising that we find that Charles Darwin himself was worried about it. And this is what he wrote in his book, The Origin of Species, in 1859. He says, "The number of intermediate varieties which have formerly existed on the earth must be truly enormous. Why then is not every geological formation and every stratum full of such intermediate links? Geology assuredly does not reveal any such finely graduated organic chain, and this perhaps is the most obvious and gravest objection which can be urged against my theory." Those who followed Darwin ignored that warning which he himself made. Later on I will go to show that there is an even graver objection than this one that Darwin himself spotted. Let's look at some of these gaps. We take the gap in the fossil record between the first simple single-celled organisms and multicelled organisms. We find that there is an enormous gap, and that in fact, all of a sudden, in the rocks, we find enormous varieties of multicelled organisms, many of them quite complex, emerging with no known predecessors. Secondly, we have a big gap from when these multicelled organisms become converted into fish. And then there is another enormous gap from when fish become amphibian and able to move about on land. There is another enormous gap from when amphibians become changed into reptiles and dinosaurs, and another from when reptiles become changed into birds or mammals. And another big one from when land mammals become changed into whales or sea mammals. And another from when land mammals become changed into men. Now, notice that all these gaps, which are enormous, all come, as I say, at the worst places, just at the very places where you would hope to see a good number of transitional varieties. There's nothing. How is it that the textbooks can skate over such enormous gaps? They do this on the basis of a few transitional forms which they feel are able to suggest that there is the possibility of change. I'll mention one example. You may have all heard of the coelacanth, the fish whose remains were discovered that has four little like feet, although it swims in the sea. Now, when the remains were first found, it was thought that here we had the beginnings of an amphibian, and that this creature would be able to at least drag itself along the land by means of these very little tiny legs. Unfortunately for the Darwinists, they actually started to discover live coelacanths off the coast of Madagascar. And unfortunately, none of these live coelacanths show the slightest inclination to go near the land and to attempt to drag themselves across it. They were perfectly at home in the sea. So, the Darwinists began to lose interest in the coelacanth, and you won't find the big song and dance made about it like they used to. There's another so-called transitional fossil that was known in Darwin's day, called the Archaeopteryx, that means ancient bird. This was a bird that had a long, bony, feathered tail. It had a jaw with teeth, and it had little claws for forearms. In other words, it looked somewhat reptilian. This was claimed triumphantly as a transitional fossil showing how reptiles could become converted into birds. But the point that was missed by the Darwinists is that this particular creature was a bird. A bird in the sense that it could fly because it had large developed wings. So there is no transitional fossil from a creature with no wings to a creature that has wings that can fly. Now that's the kind of transitional fossil that is needed to support Darwin's theory. A transition from the beginning of a new organ to one when it is able to function properly. What use is the beginnings of a pair of wings to a reptile in its need to adapt to its environment to survive? It would be more likely to be a hindrance, if anything, if the wings were not yet strong enough for the creature to rise off the ground. So when you read textbooks or hear people speaking on the television about the way in which we have transitional varieties to support Darwin's theory, take this with a pinch of salt. They would only be transitional if you saw the beginnings of a new organ, rather than this enormous jump which we always have between no organ and the complete new finished one. I'll mention another enormous problem that the Darwinists have to face. The change from reptiles to mammals. Reptiles have a jaw which is composed of four bones and an ear which is made up of one bone. The mammals into which they evolved have only one jawbone and three bones in the ear. There are no transitional fossils to show us how there could be intermediate creatures that managed somehow to change from four jawbones and one ear bone to 3 in the ear and 1 in the jaw, and manage this whilst adapting successfully over their varieties to their environment. Now that's just one. This kind of problem could be multiplied again and again and again. The gaps in the record are all in the wrong places, and they are complete gaps. So that what we see is the emergence of new organs able to function straight away. It's had to be glossed over by the Darwinists. Darwin himself was worried by the human eye. The human eye is very complex. There are, of course, very much simpler forms in nature, with simpler creatures, but all eyes require several functions to work together at the same time. Otherwise, the eye doesn't work. It doesn't see unless a number of new things created in the eye work together. Darwin himself said in 1860, he said, "To this day, the eye makes me shudder." Darwin's own words. He was also disturbed, so he tells us, by looking at the feather on a bird's tail. It worried him to know how chance mutations could bring about a feather on a bird's tail. Professor Nielsen, a Swedish scientist who has been working in the biological field for over 40 years, came to this conclusion. "It is not even possible to make a caricature of evolution out of paleobiological facts. The fossil material is now so complete that the lack of transitional series can't be explained by the scarcity of the material. The deficiencies are real. They will never be filled." There's another problem for the Darwinists, and it's this. You probably are all aware that in Australia there are a good number of creatures that are called marsupials. Marsupial because they carry their young for a period in a pouch at the front. It is thought that these creatures have a common ancestor with similar creatures back in the dinosaur period, developing from a small shrew-like creature. But the amazing thing is that though these developed separately after the Australian continent moved away from the European, although they developed separately, they produced forms which were extremely similar, so that the difference between, say, a Canadian wolf and a Tasmanian wolf is very slight in biological terms. And the same is true for anteaters, moles, and mice. Isn't it remarkable if random changes in two sets of species, separated far apart, unable to have contact with each other, in different environments, should find themselves moving in exactly the same directions, if there is no designer directing the direction of evolution? I can't leave this subject without mentioning just one lovely specimen that some of you may have heard of to illustrate the complexity of evolution. The bombardier beetle. The bombardier beetle is a beetle which shoots out a lethal fluid to kill its enemies. This lethal fluid explodes and blows up the enemy like a cannon. This fluid is made up of two chemical substances, hydroquinone and hydrogen peroxide. When the two are mixed together, they explode. So that these two don't explode inside the beetle has developed an inhibitor, chemical inhibitor. And just at the moment when it shoots this liquid out, it injects an anti-inhibitor. which neutralizes the inhibitor and enables the combination to become explosive. Try to imagine that developing by chance without all these proto-beetles blowing up in the process. There's a nice puzzle for you. This kind of puzzle can be multiplied again and again and again with charming oddities from nature. Now, we've looked at macroevolution. We've looked at the problems of bridging these enormous gaps between the species. Let's now look at microevolution, where at first the situation looks a great deal healthier for the Darwinist. Microevolution, or development within a species. And here indeed we can see natural selection at work today. For instance, there is a Lancashire moth which has both a light and a dark coloured variety. And it has been followed from before the Industrial Revolution to during the Industrial Revolution, when the trees on which it was often found gradually became blackened with soot. And you can imagine what happened, that as the trees became darker, so the lighter coloured moth began to die out because more were eaten by birds. They could be seen against the darker trunk. And so the ratio of dark-coloured moths to light-coloured moths has increased. Here the Darwinists feel they have scored a major triumph. We can see natural selection at work. Hooray. But what have they told us? Nothing that we couldn't have worked out for ourselves? Nothing that helps us to understand in any way the origin of new species? But only when you have two different varieties of a species, natural selection will select that which is best adapted to the environment rather than the other. There is no explanation of how new species originate. Let's look then at the inside of the gene itself. Genes are the carriers of the genetic code. And an enormous amount of scientific work has been going on in the last few decades studying the genes of all sorts of creatures and how they change from one generation to the next. The best studied of these is the fruit fly, a small fly which has a short lifespan, and therefore you can follow it over many generations very easily. Scientists decided that they would endeavour to speed up the process of evolution to try and see it in operation by bombarding the genes with X-rays, on the assumption that X-rays and cosmic rays from outer space were probably the means whereby genes got mutated anyway all down the ages. And so they bombarded the genes of the fruit fly to produce new strains. And what did they get? They got flies with extra pairs of wings, extra pairs of legs. They got flies with no eyes. They got flies with legs where the eyes should be, and so on. They were able to double up or juggle around with the organs that were in the fruit fly. But they could not produce a new species. Something else about the genes that doesn't help the Darwinists one little bit. It turns out that the genes are highly resistive to change. They don't like it. A leading Darwinist biologist tried for many years to significantly change the number of bristles on the back of the fruit fly. It's normally around 30-35. And he selectively bred strains to reduce and increase the number of bristles on the back. And he managed to get the bristles down to 26 on the one hand, or up to about 56 on the other. After that, he couldn't get any lower or any higher. The flies just began to die out. They wouldn't take it anymore. And then as he bred these further, he began to find that they started to move back again towards the median value. There were other flies that were developed that had no eyes. And although these flies with no eyes were inbred and inbred and inbred, after a few generations, they started coming back with eyes again, as they were before. The genes wouldn't tolerate a change for too long before they would bring the species back to where it was before. And we know, of course, that we have a good number of species living today that have remained unchanged for millions of years, such as the opossum, for instance, and many others. No change in the coelacanth that I mentioned earlier. That's how much the genes want to change if you try to make them change. Now, the Darwinists have another problem besides that of there being no transitional forms from one species to another. This other problem is this, that if their theory was correct, that is to say, if there were gradual minor changes in the form of a creature, there should be many, many monster forms in the fossil record. When I say monster forms, I mean monsters like are produced by X-ray mutation, legs in the wrong place, or even just useless appendages, bits sticking out here and there, which don't really do anything. If it was all random, where are all these monster forms to be found? There are none. If I can liken it to this, if I was to toss a coin up in the air, and if I was to say, report to you, that I tossed it up 100 times, and 100 times it had come down and started on its edge, you wouldn't believe it. You would say that's the most improbable answer coming up every time. If, on the other hand, I said I tossed it up 100 times, and 99 times the coin stayed flat on the ground, but just once it stood on its edge, you'd perhaps believe that and say, yes, that's possible. Now apply this to this gradual random mutation. And you can see that to get just one strain that is developing forwards, evolution-wise, you need many, many, many other forms which are going nowhere and should appear in the record, and they don't. All the creatures that you will find, they all have organs which serve some use or other. So not only are there no transitional forms in the fossil record, there are no monster forms either. This is a powerful argument to show that evolution has been moving in a designed direction, because all of evolution is the improbable followed by the improbable followed by the improbable. Even cosmologists now, some of them, are beginning to realize that we only have life on this planet at all because certain cosmic factors are just right. And if these cosmic factors were not just right, you couldn't have life. For instance, the background temperature of the universe has to be just right. The amount of material scattered through space has to be just right. The strength of gravity has to be just right. And many other factors. If these are all just right, then the universe can give rise to life in some part of it. But then, going back to our coin-tossing analogy, this means that if there is no cosmic designer, there must be billions and billions of other universes where the factors were not just right and life could not develop. So we find some cosmologists saying, this universe must have been designed because it is far, far too improbable to have been able to happen by chance. But we haven't even really quite touched rock bottom with this problem yet. Even supposing the Darwinists could find what they wanted and find all their transitional forms and find all their monster forms, all that would do is it would establish that the Darwinist mechanism worked, but it would not establish that this came about by chance. There is in physics a very famous law, a bit of a mouthful, called the second law of thermodynamics. But I can very simply give you the basic idea of what this law amounts to, which I'll illustrate by means of a pile of books. If I pile up a set of books or a set of bricks like that, and if I was to leave this to the wind and the weather, eventually this very ordered stack of books would become scattered, higgledy-piggledy, all over the place. Now, assuming that there was no intelligent life around, the chances of these books gradually finding themselves back again in an ordered pile is effectively nil.